From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Election campaigns are, in substantial part, all about advertising the messages. In today's social media age, the advertising scene has become a much more complex one, and that's particularly obvious in this campaign. Perhaps the most startling feature, however, on the advertising front is Clive Palmer's campaign. He said he's so far spent a mind-boggling $50 million on advertising, although industry figures put it at about $35 million. Here today to discuss campaign advertising is Andrew Hughes, who's a lecturer in marketing in the Research School of Management at the Australian National University. Andrew Hughes, can we start with your overall impression of advertising in this campaign and any comparisons, for example, with the last election in 2016?
Well, so far in 2019, we've seen a real divergence in spend and activity between the social and digital platforms and the more traditional platforms of television, radio and print, and even outdoor for that matter, like call flutes and roadside signs. So it's been interesting because this is the first real election where that split's been more evident towards digital in the majority than the previous forms of traditional media. Apart from that, though, it's stayed pretty much true to form so far, where we've seen a positive start from both leaders, where they have a getting to know you ad and then followed up by some negative ads, but also then the positive ads where they offer their policy to the electorate. But here's the thing, it is starting to change.
And how's that change working out?
Well, that change is what we've seen even right now. Here we are at the start of this week of the campaign where...
The third last week.
Correct, the third last week of the campaign. And so pre-poll voting opens today and has opened today. And the ads so far on Facebook alone by the coalition number over 230 by Labor, over 200. So what we're seeing is a huge volume of ads being pushed through social media, partly because of the cost, partly because that's where now people spend a lot of their media consumption is on social media. But what we're seeing, though, is a largely positive ad campaign being run by the coalition on social media, but Labor running very negative on social media with, though that said, some positive ad offerings, of course.
Now, right at the start of the campaign, wasn't it the other way around?
Yes, and this is the thing what we're seeing happening now in campaigns with digital and social media is that the strategy can be changed very, very quickly. You're not locked in as you were with traditional media where you might go to the big networks or the big radio stations and make a deal with them through the campaign to run ads, and those ads would be pretty much designed to happen or be released at certain times through the campaign. Now, with digital and social media, you can make an ad in literally 1 or 2 hours. You can have it released that night, which might talk about a policy which had only been announced by a party that afternoon.
Well, we saw that most dramatically when Bill Shorten was on the merry-go-round, didn't we?
Yes.
And the ad came out about him taxing, I think, every time he appeared.
Yeah, and even today, yesterday there was a big policy announcement by Labor about childcare and about their policy there on health and education. And then only this morning, so that happened late yesterday afternoon, only this morning we've seen a lot of more positive ads out by the coalition talking about their health spending, their education spending, and what they'll do in childcare as well. So that's how reactionary it is now on social media.
So why would the coalition be going positive on social media at this stage and Labor negative? One would think that Labor would be going positive because it's just announced these big spending policies.
So this is the thing about advertising in a nutshell, really, when it comes to politics, is that what you might be trying to do here is blunt the other side's messaging, not just put forward your own value offering, so to speak, about policies or personality, i.e. leadership from the Prime Minister. It could be also done to blunt the messaging which comes out then on social media or digital media platforms or even traditional media platforms from Labor in this case. So you might run a very positive message and say, hey, we're doing all these things already, we're governing. And so you're trying to reduce the risk in any thought pattern someone has about voting for your party.
Now, it's always said by the parties that while the voters say they don't like negative messaging, negative ads, that those are the ones that really cut through. Is that right? Does the research show that's true?
No, not at all. My research, and I've actually measured in a lab setting, an environmental setting, where I looked at people watching TV over an hour, and during the ad breaks, I put in political ads along how you might normally watch TV at this time of year, for example, during this part of the election campaign. And what I found was that negative ads turn people off. People actually lost attention on a negative ad very, very quickly. A positive ad, on the other hand, works very, very well. So the highest emotional response I recorded on an ad was done by For the Greens, by an ad agency in Sydney as part of a TV show called Gurren Transfer. And it was a very positive ad, and people recalled that more than any other political ad they watched, which is a sign of effectiveness.
Why then do the parties think that the negative ads work? Is this a subtle thing over time?
Yeah, I think it is. I think back in the past, they probably did work quite well because it did have that effect of highlighting the risk of voting for another party. And that's the thing you have to do in a political campaign, which is quite unique in advertising, is you try to have to influence someone's behaviour from being unaware of an issue to voting for your side in maybe the space of 4 or 5 weeks. That's really hard to achieve if you think about it. To try and change your behaviour in 4 to 5 weeks, even if I was doing a normal product, so to speak, is difficult enough. But let alone in politics, where the existing attitudes most people have towards political advertising is negative in itself, be it positive or negative ad they're watching. So here we're trying to change that behaviour very, very quickly. And people thought negative ad worked well for that reason. But we're in 2019. How we consume and use information is far different to what it was in 2009 or 2000 or 1989 or whatever the case was in the older campaigns where traditional media ruled. Everything is different in this day and age.
Well, one of the things that's very different is that you can stream ads to particular cohorts of people, to particular electorates. How does this work and how much of this is being done?
Okay, so we learn about these two tools from Facebook primarily called custom audiences and lookalike audiences. These two things have revolutionized political campaigning because what it means you can do, you can create a custom audience for an ad. You can say, please target people who are male, aged 30 to 45, who live in this area of Australia, and please show them this message. And Facebook will go off and do it for you. Now, the brilliant thing about this is not just those people get to see your ad, it's also those people get to respond to your ad. So you're building up a database now of people who like that messaging, which means you can even give them more targeted messaging as the campaign goes on. So you get them more engaged or involved with your messaging than, say, traditional media, where it's just someone on a couch watching a TV at night. So it's a lot more effective than it ever used to be.
Do you have any worries about the issues this raises for privacy because all this data has to be collected?
Yes, indeed I do, because we saw only recently in America, one of the big platforms used here in Australia by political parties for database building is called Nation Builder. Now, Nation Builder is a community-based app and website. It's very effective, very powerful. It was hacked 2 years ago in America. Its data hacked was one of the biggest in history. 200 million Americans had their data compromised. That's a huge amount of people. If something similar were to happen in Australia, of course, it does raise that issue of all this data being collected on people, which is very sensitive, could then get into the wrong hands and then actually lead to an outcome on an election, maybe through someone else using that information against the will of the nation, you might say.
Do you have any idea roughly the proportion so far of dollars being spent on traditional versus digital advertising?
Just based on what I'm seeing on social media and what I'm seeing on traditional media, the spend would appear to be 50-50, but tipping now more and more in favour of digital. In fact, I think this will be the first election campaign we see where the spend is largely on digital and social media compared to traditional media. The other thing to know about this too is the number of ads, the sheer volume of ads, is probably the highest we've ever seen in Australian politics because of the number of ads just on Facebook alone. As I speak right now today, would be literally in the hundreds. We don't see that many on TV, of course.
And for parties wanting to advertise on social media compared to traditional media, what's the cost there?
The cost,
placing ads.
Yeah, the cost is very, very low on social media. So, I mean, just to have an ad
you
shown to someone.
Big, bang for your buck.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Put it in perspective. So the cost of, and this is based on prior research, the cost to reach 1,000 people on, and reach means people to look at your ad, eyeballs on the ad, in the newspaper is around $32 per 1,000. On social media, we are talking maybe $2 per 1,000. And the money goes up, of course, if someone clicks on an ad and then acts on it. So that then it becomes a bit more expensive, but not that expensive compared to traditional media.
And what platforms are the most popular or effective when it comes to digital advertising?
Facebook's very good because people are just the sheer volume of people on Facebook and how Facebook's used by people. It is changing slightly. There was discussion on then the segmentation of different social media brands themselves and how they appeal to different markets. So a good example is Snapchat. 2016 in America, for example, was called the Snapchat election because everyone was hot about Snapchat at the time. 2019 is different. Snapchat's dropped away from that now. We don't see Snapchat being used like that at all in 2019. We see Pinterest has become very popular. And then we have what's called dark social. Now, dark social is WhatsApp and WeChat and things like that.
Well, WeChat, of course, is quite an interesting phenomenon in this campaign. What are you picking up about that?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's a foreign website. And we have foreign interference laws, but yet the parties themselves are the ones active on a foreign platform. So it does raise the question then about foreign interference if we're using a social media platform based in another nation for our domestic politics. What questions it raises about then the involvement of other stakeholder groups on politics in Australia by just sheer use of those platforms.
But we're not hearing much about that worry, are we?
No, we're not, which is fascinating because it's so now it's a good thing because we see it as part of diversity and campaigning and outreach to communities which probably weren't that active politically in Australia, but people are now seeing this as a good thing to use these platforms to get engagement and involvement in politics we never had before.
So when we talk about getting to the ethnic vote, how is that all working out in an advertising sense beyond what we've spoken of so far?
So what we're seeing and picking up on is images from people who are noticing call flutes or roadside signs where they're in different languages. We're seeing different ads on social media, be it spoken, for example, or even visual ads like TV ads on through Facebook, which are spoken in different languages.
Ethnic press.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really fascinating to see it play out because, again, this is a form of micro-targeting. And this is the new buzzword of politics in the modern era. It's micro-targeting, it's micro-segmentation.
Another buzzword, of course, is personal branding. And we do see politicians do this pretty extensively. How do you think that affects their advertising strategies and how do they align or not align, distinguish themselves from their parties in certain cases?
It's really important to do a personal branding approach in politics because it's co-branding and leadership is a brand. Your style of leadership is speaking about your brand itself. So this election, for example, the most recent ads dropped by Scott Morrison last night and this morning have him very much social, casual, sleeves rolled up. Yeah, getting on with the job, but also being
Shearing
approachable.
Sheep.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very engageable, right? And he's trying to go for the resonance because if you can resonate with the leader, you can resonate with the party brand, which means then you get that vote happening. And remember, it's as I said, it's that 5-week behavior change. So if I can use the leader to do that, fantastic. If someone can relate to the leader, better. And that's why having Bill Shorten not so popular has maybe been a bit of a hindrance to Labor in the early parts of the campaign, because I've had to switch that emphasis away from Bill Shorten and onto other personalities or other personal brands in the campaign, like Christina Keneally, like Brendan O'Connor, to try and raise the brand profile and resonance factor, but also to put the emphasis on the policies more front and centre as part of Labor's strategy this election.
So given Bill Shorten's unpopularity in the polls in a personal sense, is the Labor campaign trying to portray him in more traditional leadership terms rather than kicking footballs, shearing
yes.
sheep, whatever?
Yes, exactly. Because Labor's approach to Bill Shorten is, again, to think about to people reducing the risk. So what's the risk of Bill Shorten becoming Prime Minister? Is he ready for the top job? Is he a leadership material? So what they've been trying to emphasise very subtly in their advertising campaign material, and we saw this with his very first ad he did when the election was announced, was having dressed in suits. It's a very subtle signal to people out there that he's leadership, that he's leading the country, he's ready to be Prime Minister, he's ready to start governing.
But it's all right to run round in the mornings.
Exactly
even
right.
Even with a rugby player.
Yeah, and you know,
especially with a rugby player, perhaps.
That comparison to John Howard, by people are making right now about how John Howard used to go for morning walks, is helping Bill Shorten, because he wants that comparison, because John Howard was seen as a safe, stable leader. And that, in a way, is part of the brand association he wants. He wants that safe, stable leadership brand resonance onto his own personal brand. So getting it via Howard is no bad thing. Much the same as Kevin Rudd loved being called Howard Light when he ran in 2007.
Let's talk about Clive Palmer, because he surely is a new phenomenon, even though he's an old phenomenon. We've been there before in 2013, but we haven't had this sort of spend before.
No, this is remarkable. By even just commercial marketing standards, to see a spend of around $2 million per week in an election campaign is just remarkable. So far, both major parties have spent around $2 million, if Nielsen figures are accurate, but Clive Palmer is spending that per week. And he so far has spent...
And for a long time he's been spending a lot. Months and months.
Yeah, correct. And he's also been doing a positive groundwork campaign. So a lot of interaction on social media platforms like memes on Twitter, where he encouraged people to make memes about his brand, about himself, the game, his website. So the game was an app, of course, you could download there for a short period of time. It had privacy concerns because it could track you location-wise. But then it's all done in a positive, engaged way. And I think it's working for Clive Palmer.
But do you think that advertising will be more effective for him, but when he gets to being interviewed more, then the effect of the advertising mightn't be so great because people Yes. will see him under pressure, under scrutiny?
Yes. And also, here's the thing about personal branding too, as well, is that when you have a personal brand like Clive, if he becomes too much of the focus of the brand, then people have recall about past experiences of his brand. And they might go, oh, hang on, Clive, that's right. He did all the following bad things. They might not remember all the good things he did, but they will remember the bad. And that's just the way our minds work. We're more likely to remember bad information or negative information than we are positive. And so that can come back to haunt you in a campaign like this, where the focus could switch on to you. Now, in his campaign commercials, he's also running 50-50 of himself, but also his candidates. And his candidates are very much selected on the principle of who they're going to target with the market.
But a lot of his candidates are now under question, for example, even under Section 44 of the Constitution.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's the whole point, I suppose, when it comes to scrutiny, is that these candidates then start to lose their brand appeal and their resonance. They start to move away from being someone you might trust or see as, you know, maybe someone you could put your vote into, to now being more risk. They're not less risk anymore. And I think Clive Palmer, for a while, they didn't mind, again, being associated with the coalition brand, because it meant that his brand was seen as less risky compared to other brands in the marketplace like One Nation or Qatar Australia Party or someone else from the far right.
In a way, a message here is that you get all this free publicity when you're interviewed and talking in the media, but you can't control that publicity to a great extent, whereas the ads you can control.
Yes, and that's the, I suppose, what Clive Palmer thought he might do with his campaign.
And has done so far.
Yes, is to ignore scrutiny or brush it off, Donald Trump style, and we saw Trump do it very well, and he still does it very well, the way he controls messaging via social media such as Twitter announcements. But advertising gives you control of the message. It's your message. You're paying for it. You own it. But when it comes to the media, your message will be dissected, pulled apart, critically analysed, and then you have to face the scrutiny of the people eventually.
So just finally, do you think that the Palmer example is a case for having caps on advertising?
Yes. And I mean by caps here, not just money. I also think the number of ads, because I think they'll become more important as we embrace social media more and more in campaigns. As that tipping point between traditional and social media goes more in favor of social media, just as an example where we have that hundreds of ads by both sides running right now on Facebook alone, let alone the other social media platforms. In the future, I believe the conversation will be on how many ads should Australians be exposed to as a quantity, not by dollar value.
But where does this intersect with the free speech debate?
Yeah, exactly right. So maybe one point to look at it is maybe we'll look at the concern. The concern from a lot of people is that they hate negative advertising. It upsets them. It turns them off democracy. They feel as though politicians are navel-gazing or not concerned about them. So maybe one point to have is maybe when voting opens from pre-polling voting onwards until election day, that parties can only ever run positive commercials on all or any platform. could be just one way to have it. The other way is also thinking about the power of what money can do. If you have a lot of money, then obviously you can buy a lot of influence, because on these social media platforms, they're private companies. They are there to make profit. Therefore, if you have lots of money, you can actually have the perception that your brand's very powerful or very influential. You can actually smother the market with messaging. But then if you're a very minor party, it might actually mean that you don't have a voice at all. And maybe that's something to be looked at as well.
But these debates also take us down the road of truth in advertising,
yes,
which is almost impossible to
yeah.
deal with in election campaigns or yes. political advertising generally,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's truth in advertising laws right now in politics in South Australia, but I can't recall a case where it's actually been applied. And so maybe that gets to that bigger discussion on how do we approach truth in political advertising, and shouldn't people have a right to know what's accurate and what isn't?
And there'll always be debates about even the facts.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe we're all waiting for that crowdsource party like we've seen from overseas in different markets like M5S in Italy, even like the Centre Alliance for a while, they had that crowdsource feel to it, that maybe that's a centre party we've all been searching for and hoping for to put its hand up, where it's going to be truth and honesty. The comedian in the Ukraine who won the presidency because it was more about honesty and truth and advertising. Maybe that's what we're all hoping to see happen in Australia. Maybe that's a utopian ideal, isn't it? Really?
Or the satirical show. Andrew Hughes, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Michelle, it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And that's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another election interview very soon.
And if you're itching for more election analysis, check out The Conversation's other podcast, Trust Me, I'm an Expert. You can find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to Politics with Michelle Grattan right now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.